What is the crime exactly that you're accusing him of?
You know what the crime is. The crime is very obvious to everybody.
You don't know what the crime is, do you, Donald Trump? You ain't got a clue.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. In Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF, as well as other fine terrestrial affiliates. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, even during pandemics. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for tuning in to The Bradcast, your stay-at-home radio companion. Of course, that may only apply to about half the states at this point.
Your mileage may vary.
Indeed. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
It was election day in a few states on Tuesday, with special elections for the U.S. House in Wisconsin and California. You know, that race that Donald Trump and the Republicans told everyone on Twitter over the weekend was being stolen by Democrats. Well, as of this hour, it looks like the Democratic candidates appear to have lost in both states. So apparently Democrats are just not very good at stealing elections, at least not as good as Republicans, maybe.
I think it's funny how Trump just kind of dropped that whole stealing the election thing.
He doesn't talk about it at all. Yeah, well, I have a feeling we may not hear him talking about that particular election for very much.
Yep.
But there was a regular, or regular enough, given that we're in the middle of a pandemic, primary election in Nebraska as well on Tuesday, where Joe Biden, as expected, defeated Bernie Sanders, who has suspended his campaign and has endorsed the former vice president, but is remaining on the ballot in hopes of collecting more delegates between now and the time of the Democrats' probably virtual national convention in July, in hopes of moving the party to the progressive left. With 100% reporting today, however, Biden appears to have defeated Sanders 76.7% to 13.4%, which, if those numbers for Sanders stay below 15%, mean that he will not pick up any delegates, I believe, from Nebraska this year. But there was some very good news for progressives in Nebraska last night, as Kara Eastman won her primary to take on Republican Donald Bacon this November in what the nation's John Nichols called a huge win for progressives. We'll be joined in a bit by a longtime progressive U.S. House champion, Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com, to discuss what happened on Tuesday night and what it means for progressives and the Democratic Party moving forward. The California special election was held mostly by mail, though that did not keep Republicans and the president of the United States from freaking out over the weekend when an extra in-person polling place was set up in the diverse city of Lancaster, which had no in-person polling places set up in it. That after the town's Republican mayor Republican mayor objected to the lack of a polling place there. That led the chair, LA County said, okay, sure, we'll add one. That led the chair of the National Republican Campaign Committee to declare a, quote, call to arms, claiming that Democrats were trying to, quote, steal the election by adding that one polling place, with Trump taking the bait, of course, and declaring it to be a, quote, rigged election. Also, he said it was supposed to be an all vote by mail election, which, of course, it never was. That was being stolen, he said, by California's Governor Gavin Newsom, which is just ridiculous. But Donald Trump excels at ridiculous, and given what appear to be the results of that election, I bet he won't be calling it rigged anymore,
yeah,
as you said.
I think so.
In the meantime, Tuesday marked the first major in-person elections in more than a month in both Wisconsin and Nebraska. Nebraska, which held its presidential and down-ballot primary elections, was one of just 8 states never to issue a statewide stay-at-home order amid the coronavirus pandemic. And Wisconsin, which held a special election in the 7th Congressional District Tuesday, was, you'll recall, a site of absolute chaos on April 7 when it held its presidential primary in person. Thankfully, at least according to Nathaniel Rakich at 538.com, it looks like both elections on Tuesday passed without major incident, though we will have to check back after a week or two of incubation time in both states to find out for sure. Nebraska, according to Rakich, was even a notable success. He says in both states, officials took tons of precautions to protect the health of voters and poll workers. In Nebraska, each poll worker received a safety kit that included an N95 mask, gloves, hand sanitizer, disinfectant wipes, and a face shield. Polling places provided masks to voters who showed up without them. And poll workers were instructed to disinfect everything that voters touched between every single use. Of course, it helps in Nebraska that they do not force voters to use disease vector touchscreen voting systems.
No, that's good.
They opt to use hand-marked paper ballots across the entire state. In Wisconsin, the state also provided workers with personal protective equipment, and there were hand sanitizer stations at polling places. And in at least one jurisdiction, plastic screens separated workers from voters, and curbside voting was also an option. In both states, 538 reports, officials enforced social distancing, and each voter was given his or her own pen to mark their ballot with, and then to keep so others did not have to touch it. There were no reports of significant lines at the polling places in either state. Well, that helps. Unlike back in last month in parts of Wisconsin, the ruralness of the 7th district in Wisconsin, of course, helped to keep long lines from forming. In Nebraska, even big cities were able to avoid closing many of their polling places, although election officials in Douglas County, which is Omaha, said that some polling places, such as those located in retirement communities, were closed due to the threat. In total, 200 of its usual 222 polling places were, in fact, open on Tuesday, and Douglas County Election Commissioner Brian Cruz said that if poll workers asked not to work those elections, the county had plenty of time to find replacements for them, and that helped keep things going smoothly. It also helped that in-person turnout was very, very, very light. That, thanks to a huge percentage of Nebraskans who requested mail ballots. Rakich notes that no fewer than 41% of registered voters requested an absentee ballot. Notably, Nebraska had mailed every voter a form to request an absentee ballot, which may have contributed to the high rate of mail voting. There was something else surprising, he said, about the numbers of ballots that were returned. Despite both a pandemic and an uncontested presidential race, Nebraska looks like it will shatter its 48-year-old record for most votes ever cast in a primary.
Really?
Yeah. So making it easier for everyone to vote safely by mail during a pandemic actually helps boost turnout. Who could have guessed it? Donald Trump, of course, guessed it, which is why he and Republicans are doing all that they can to restrict access to vote by mail this year, even in the middle of a pandemic. But given their apparent success on Tuesday in California, which we'll discuss with Howie in a bit, maybe Republicans shouldn't be quite so afraid of vote by mail. Of course, Trump pretends his concern with absentee voting is that it's all fraudulent, is what he said. Though when he was asked why he voted absentee in a recent Florida election, which he now declares to be his residence, he said that he was allowed to. Well, he was allowed to, but I guess all the other voters who would like to enjoy that way of voting, they're all frauds, right? But the question now is, was Donald Trump actually a Florida resident when he voted recently via absentee, or was he actually committing the voter fraud that he pretends Democrats are carrying out by absentee? Evidence suggests that yes, like former GOP superstar Ann Coulter in Florida. Remember her, Desi Doyen?
Oh, yes.
Like her, Trump may have committed fraud by voting by absentee in the state earlier this year. And yes, if you're interested in the huge amount of evidence absolutely confirming that Ann Coulter committed voter fraud several times, first in Florida, please feel free to go to bradblog.com/coulterfraud. Where I broke that story in great detail some years ago. But anyway, back to Trump's voter fraud in Florida. President Trump, Washington Post reported yesterday, has temporarily withdrawn a controversial dock proposal at his Palm Beach resort that had raised larger questions about the legality of the change of his official residency from New York to Florida. The decision to withdraw that proposal was disclosed in a letter sent to the Palm Beach mayor and town council on Monday. It came 3 days after the Washington Post published a story that outlined assertions by local attorneys who argue that agreements Trump entered into with the town prevent him from living at the Mar-a-Lago resort and may have precluded him, therefore, from legally registering to vote in Florida. Trump had come under scathing criticism from his Palm Beach neighbors and their attorneys, who accused him and his legal team of attempting to jam through this dock request at the Mar-a-Lago resort. While the nation's attention was otherwise focused on the coronavirus pandemic, and the town's council is only able to hold meetings electronically. In the letter now withdrawing their proposal after it's gotten this much attention, Trump's Palm Beach attorney Harvey Oyer III cited, quote, "the extraordinary circumstances that we find ourselves in" as the reason for the decision to withdraw the application, but he made no specific mention of the coronavirus, which critics say is because Trump wants to pretend that everything is normal. What pandemic? We're just busy right now. That's all. We don't have time to pursue this with the extraordinary circumstances we find ourselves in. Reginald Stambaugh, an attorney who represents one of Mar-a-Lago's neighbors, said that he is hopeful that the president will now permanently drop the dock proposal. That is a battle which stretches back to 2018, focusing on complaints about the possibility of disruptive party boats and potential environmental damage with that dock. But it was given a jolt of national significance late last year when Trump made headlines by changing his domicile from New York to Florida using Mar-a-Lago as his address. Now, the dock issue is gone for now. But according to the attorney Stambaugh, quote, "one prevalent issue remains lingering, whether President Trump still considers the Mar-a-Lago club to be his residence." So after he applied for the dock permit, attorneys and historical preservationists in South Florida began digging into town records. They unearthed an agreement that Donald Trump made back in 1993 to convert Mar-a-Lago from a single-family residence, which it was at the time, to a private club owned by one of Trump's corporations. The agreement included a provision that bans members from using the club's guest rooms for longer than 7 days at a time, three times a year. Trump's attorney at the time assured Palm Beach City Council members back then that Trump would not live at the club as part of this agreement. It also banned, by the way, construction of a dock. But Trump was asking for that condition to be waived in this application. So Trump's attorneys originally argued that the dock was necessary for the president's protection because, you know, whatever. That claim was included in an application that made no mention of Mar-a-Lago being the president's home. But in a later application, the rationale for the dock was changed. Trump asserted that the club is his, quote, personal residence. The attorney Stambaugh said he cannot have it both ways. It's either a club or a residence, but it is not both. Florida's voting laws apply to citizen Trump. If he resides there, he will have to close the club. For now, it's a club, which means it cannot be Trump's residence, which means, like Ann Coulter after she moved to Florida, Donald Trump just committed voter fraud in the state of Florida by voting with an absentee ballot there, even though he does not have a permanent residence in the Sunshine State, which is required to vote there. Which means, yes, according to Florida's voting laws, which are very strict, by the way, at least when Democrats appear to violate them, Donald Trump is a voter fraud felon in that state. I promise you, if this had been a Democratic president or a Democratic anybody exposed to having done this, he or she would be facing charges for it. I promise you. But as you know, Trump is allowed to violate any and all laws however he sees fit. But at least when it comes to voter fraud, I guess he knows how easy it is to commit fraud with vote by mail.
Yes.
So when will Fox News run their Mar-a-Lago gate chyrons declaring Trump a voter fraud criminal? Don't hold your breath for that, I suspect, especially since that part of the propaganda network screens are currently filled up with the word Obamagate. Even though neither they or even Trump, apparently, who started tweeting out the word over the weekend, actually knows what the hell that means. Obamagate is next on the broadcast. Then Howie Klein. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want.
Trump used to play that at his rallies.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of there. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. There are some serious goings on right now at the Department of Justice, where Donald Trump's attorney general and fixer, Bill Barr, is undermining the department in an unprecedented way. Most recently, and not just the department, but the rule of law itself, most recently by filing that motion to withdraw charges against Trump's first of four national security advisors, General Michael Flynn, who pleaded guilty twice. He pleaded guilty. He admitted he did it to lying to federal officials regarding his conversations with Russian agents before Donald Trump took office and about being an undeclared agent for Turkey, even while serving in the Trump administration as its national security advisor. So some pretty serious crimes that he admitted to. Well, though I suspect we'll get into more details on all of this at another time, the federal judge in that case right now is not ready to drop those charges against Michael Flynn. Remember, this is a motion from the DOJ. The judge does not have to accept it. Flynn had been awaiting sentencing until Barr moved in to get him off the hook in a motion that all of the career line prosecutors who worked on the Flynn case for years, they all refused to sign that motion. Judge Emmett Sullivan released a somewhat cryptic ruling yesterday, saying essentially that he would be opening up the case to friend of the court briefs if anyone wished to offer them now that there is apparently nobody left at the DOJ able to represent the rule of law. So we will see what happens. Sullivan does not have to accept Barr's motion. It would be very unusual if he didn't, but he could just go ahead and sentence Flynn anyway. All of this just part of the still unfolding corrupt con job that Trump is hoping to pull off before this year's critical presidential election. Part of that scheme was unveiled this weekend when Trump asserted that the DOJ's prosecution of Flynn was somehow a scheme masterminded by Barack Obama. Seriously. And, of course, Fox News is now reliably running with that ball. As Walter Eininkel noted yesterday at Daily Coast, the Trump administration, in hopes of deflecting focus from their catastrophic handling of our country's public health and economic well-being, while creating some kind of a faux scandal, placing blame on former President Obama that they can somehow connect to Joe Biden, they've begun something they're branding as Obamagate. The basic premise is that then President Barack Obama illegally created an FBI witch hunt to illegally wiretap and entrap Trump's criminal national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Well, you would think, with all the corruption that Trump has pretended Obama was masterminding, including what Trump calls the Russia hoax, that this great Obamagate plan would have actually been used against Trump during the campaign by Obama before Trump was elected rather than afterwards. But don't try to make too much sense of Donald Trump, because nothing good comes of that. But Eininkel of Daily Coast posted a swell clip from Fox News on Tuesday where their attempt to push the Obamagate nonsense. There it was at the bottom of the screen, a great big Obamagate during this conversation. Well, that attempt did not go so well, as national security lawyer Bradley Moss was brought on to discuss the legal ramifications of whatever Obamagate is supposed to be. And it did not go well for the poor Fox News lady who was instructed to push this nonsense.
You've handled a number of these cases. What do you make of this new release of all of these transcripts, the notes we found the week before, texts, all kinds of things that now are raising a lot of questions for people about the Flynn prosecution and the Russia investigation?
Yeah, I'm sitting here trying to figure out what exactly constitutional deprivation was there. What is the crime that people think, you know, Barack Obama and Joe Biden are going to be prosecuted under? To be clear, and this is using the words of President Trump and his lawyers for the last 3 years, any sitting president can get any classified information they want. According to Donald Trump, they can launch any investigation they want. They can tell the FBI to pursue only particular individuals. This is not me saying it. This is what Donald Trump's been saying for 3 years. This was their argument during the Mueller probe. This was their argument during the impeachment investigation, that the president has this kind of authority. So what did we find out? That Barack Obama was aware that about intelligence intercepts on the Russian ambassador when he was talking with General Flynn, that there had just been an attack on our election a couple months earlier. We were still dealing with the fallout of Russian election interference in 2016. There was a concern about a counterintelligence problem with Michael Flynn, and they had a discussion. I'm shocked. I can't believe they had that conversation. What is the crime?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there.
What is the crime? Donald Trump has said a president can do anything, and nobody can identify the crime. And this poor Fox lady was pushing it like it's a real crime. People are really worried about what happened, and all this material is coming out.
Quick, go to a commercial break.
Even Donald Trump does not know what the crime is. He was asked about it at a White House presser on Monday by Washington Post Phil Rucker.
Obamagate. It's been going on for a long time. It's been going on from before I even got elected. And it's a disgrace that it happened. And if you look at what's gone on, and if you look at now all of this information that's being released, and from what I understand, that's only the beginning. Some terrible things happened, and it should never be allowed to happen in our country again. And you'll be seeing what's going on over the coming weeks. But I wish you'd write honestly about it. But unfortunately, you choose not to do so. Yeah, John, please.
What is the crime exactly that you're accusing him of?
You know what the crime is. The crime is very obvious to everybody. All you have to do is read the newspapers, except yours. John, please.
He doesn't know what the crime
is,
does he?
Of course he doesn't, because there isn't one.
God, he's an idiot. All right. We got a. By the way, that was after Trump called it the biggest political crime in American history by far on Sunday. And he tweeted, "Obamagate makes Watergate look small time" on Monday morning, but he can't name what the crime is. Anyway, how the hell do we get rid of this guy come November? Our friend Howie Klein may have a few ideas. He'll join us next to discuss Tuesday's special U.S. House elections in Wisconsin and California and a big win for progressives in Nebraska. That's next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Do you enjoy your non-corporatized, commercial-free Bradcast? Yeah, me too. But we need your help to stay that way. Please consider supporting the investigative blogging, broadcasting, and muckraking that we do here on the Bradcast and the Green News Report and bradblog.com with a donation. It's easy. Stop by bradblog.com/donate and drop a few dollars in the tip jar. You can make a one-time contribution or an automatic monthly donation of any amount you like. It's easy. It'll take you about 60 seconds, and you'll help me and Desi stay on the air to continue our troublemaking and muckraking without the corporate influence of anyone. Got it? Thanks. Stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us out today. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. On Tuesday night, Howie Klein of Down With Tyranny reports three important congressional races ended. Nancy Pelosi, Sherry Bustos, who's the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and the DCCC as a whole, he writes, need to think closely about what happened. One contest was a regular primary election in Omaha, Nebraska, and two were special elections to fill vacated U.S. House seats in Wisconsin and California, where members had resigned, respectively, one Republican seat in Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District and one Democratic seat in California's 25th Congressional District. In each special election, the victor will fill the seat until January, at which point the winner of this November's regular general election will then take the seat, writes Howie Klein. Joining us now to discuss lessons learned, if any, from those Tuesday contests and what progressives can look forward to with nearly 20 states still left to hold primary elections over the next 2 months or so, is the great Howie Klein of the longtime progressive blog DownWithTyranny.com. Howie Klein, long time no talk to. Welcome back to the Bradcast, sir.
Thanks. Good to hear your voice again on the other end of my phone.
Yes, it is. And one day,
but
perhaps,
Brad, if I wrote the 2nd congressional district,
yeah,
take away that great, because it was the 7th congressional district.
No, you didn't, actually. I'm the one who screwed that up. It was the 7th congressional district. I mistyped that. Sorry about that. You got it right. I got it wrong, as usual.
And do you remember Sean Duffy?
Yeah, from Real World?
Yes,
I do.
It was his seat that he gave
up. I know. We're not there yet. Hang on. We're hold that back. Let's start in Nebraska, because I think we could use some what I think is good news today, Howie. Really, the best news of the night, I think, for progressives in that state's primary, where progressive Kara Eastman won the party's nomination bigly, defeating Ann Ashford, the wife of former centrist Democratic congressman.
No.
Okay, well, that is how the world, what do they call it? The Omaha World Herald called her centrist.
All media refers to right-wing blue dogs. They call them centrist. Centrist and moderate are two really good terms. They're very charged terms in people's minds. And people love the word moderate. They love the word centrist. These people aren't centrist. They are at the extreme right fringe of the Democratic Party.
Okay, all right. Well, we will get to that, I promise, Howie. First, the good news. Let's see. Kara Eastman defeated Ashford, who was married to the former blue dog right-wing Democratic Congressman Brad Ashford by some 30 points. That was a 61-31 point landslide. And so I know a lot of progressives are very happy about that, and I suspect this is the race that may have been on at the top of mind when you called out Nancy Pelosi and Sherry Bustos to, quote, think closely about what happened on Tuesday. So tell me, Howie, what happened on Tuesday?
Well, I'll tell you, although actually, don't try to read my mind because you got it wrong.
Okay.
I was really thinking about the California race, although this one too, but the California race, which we're going to get to soon, was foremost in my mind. Now, Kara ran in 2018 against the former congressman, the husband of Ann Ashford, Brad Ashford, the Blue Dog. And it was very, very close. The DCCC was overtly in favor of him and working hard for him. They had to make believe that they were neutral this time, but they weren't. They were trying to help Ann Ashford as well. Although Ann and Brad are very wealthy, and they put in about $250,000, but they put in more at the end. So about $350,000 of their own money into this race, trying to win it, and they fail. They flop really badly, and Kara, you know, is for Medicare for all, for the Green New Deal. She's for a broad progressive agenda. She didn't take sides between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren because both of them endorsed her. And she has, the way I see Kara, and by the way, Blue America endorsed her both in 2018 and this year, and I know her fairly well, an old punk rocker.
Yep.
She was a punk rocker. And her husband is a punk rocker. She's someone who is happy to go out there and fight hard for progressive ideals. She doesn't try to hide the fact that she's the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, a lot of Democrats in districts, swing districts like this one, this is Omaha, basically Omaha and some of the suburbs, you know, they try to take on like a Republican light patina. Well, Kara's not like that. Kara's out there talking with her neighbors about how good Medicare is and Medicare for all is and how important it would be to pass the Green New Deal. So you know, I admire her, and she did way better this time than she did in 2018, and I have every reason to believe that she's going to beat the Republican, Donald Bacon, this time. You know, Brad, you know this, of course, but it's almost never does a first-time challenger beat an incumbent in a primary. I mean, it almost never happens. And it's really, really tough to go up against your party establishment in a primary. It's tough for Republicans, too, but it's much harder for Democrats, and they almost never do it. However, where they succeed is in the second time. That's how we got Donna Edwards. Mm-hmm. That's how we got Alan Grayson. That it just takes more than one time, and that's what happened with Marie Newman a few weeks ago, where she took on Dan Lipinski. The first time Lipinski edged back to re-election, and this time she won. And the same with Kara.
Well,
she got beaten out last time, and this time she won, and I think she'll go on to beat Bacon, who beat her by only 2 points last time.
Well, and I want to ask about that, the upcoming race, and whether her chances will be any better than 2 years ago in a moment. But just for the moment, sticking on this race, the Omaha World Herald reports that during the primary, Ashford, who was running as a Democrat, but she's actually, they report, a former Republican.
Yeah, and they didn't put quotation marks around the former, unfortunately.
No.
When I would write it, I would have written it with quotation marks.
Well, they said a centrist former Republican is what they called Ashford. Anyway, she echoed the Republican incumbent in this case, Don Bacon, from 2 years ago in that race, arguing that Eastman's policies are too extreme for most voters in the district. So what sort of policies was Ashford regarding there as too extreme for this part of Nebraska? Is this Medicare for all? Anything else? And by the way,
all of it.
Eastman did lose last time around in what was otherwise one of the best years for Democratic candidates across the country in decades in 2018. So
it came very close.
Yeah.
And in terms of losing and winning, virtually every single candidate that won
got more than $1 million from the DCCC. Some of them, many millions of dollars from the DCCC, and she got nothing from the DCCC.
So will she get anything this time around from the DCCC? She lost by 2 points last time. World Herald says this time Eastman will have the support of the National Democratic Establishment, which failed to jump in with both feet to help her when she lost narrowly 2 years ago. But is that true? Will Eastman be supported by the Dems?
I don't think that the World Herald knows if they will or not. I don't think anyone knows. And she may be supported this time. They want the seat, and they have no choice, and they're not going to have an Ashford again to lean back on next time. So they're going to. My guess is that they will support her. We'll see. They'll drag their feet. Last time I remember, when she beat Ashford, the DCCC person, who's no longer there, who was in charge of that area, was so furious that she beat his pal that he did everything to keep the DTrip from giving her any money. And there were people at the DTrip who wanted to, and this one person just prevented it and prevented it and prevented it.
Well, before we get to Wisconsin, one other thought here, a thought or two, I guess, on Nebraska and Eastman. Our friend, progressive journalist John Nichols of The Nation, called the win, quote, a huge victory for progressives. But Dave Wasserman of Cook Political Report tweeted, one, likely missed opportunity for House Democrats as Kara Eastman defeats Ann Ashford in Nebraska 2.
So let me tell you something about Wasserman. I don't know if he's your best friend or your brother or anything, but
Wasserman is, as it turns out, is my brother. But go ahead.
So your brother is really good to listen to and to pay attention to.
Yeah.
About 2 or 3 days before the election, so maybe like Sunday before the first Tuesday of November.
Yeah.
Actually knows something, but before then, no, he doesn't know anything. He gets it wrong. If you follow him and you follow the Cook Report, at this point in the elections, they never get anything right. I don't know why people always refer to them. They always get it wrong. Never, ever get it right.
Well,
if he says that the Democrats missed an opportunity by putting up a progressive and that they would have done better, you just take the opposite of that, and that's much, much more likely to be true. I'm sorry. I mean, if he's your brother.
No, he's not my brother. He's not my friend at all. He's fine. I think I had him on the show one time years ago, but no, you can say anything you want about him.
Okay. Well, you know, like I said, he does know what he's talking about a day or two before, and he's good a day or two after. He gets it all right 2 days after the election, never misses. But this much time out, Cook is a joke. They can get it all wrong. And you're better off just saying whatever they say, go to the opposite, and that's what's going
to
happen.
Well, there you go. That's why I wanted to get your response to Wasserman on that one. All right, let's move to Wisconsin here very quickly. Wisconsin's 7th district, which, just to underscore again how obscenely gerrymandered the state of Wisconsin is, the 7th district apparently covers parts of 26 counties. Which is just mind-blowing to me in Wisconsin.
Although most of them have no one living in them.
Well, maybe not, but 26 counties in one congressional district. So the Republican easily won the special election to fill the seat of, former MTV Real World star and 2010 Tea Party Republican and big-time Trump supporter Sean Duffy. He resigned late last year in the district that had gone for Obama in 2008, for Romney in 2012, then big time for Trump by about 20 points in 2016 on Tuesday. What's that?
After having gone for Bernie in a big way in the primaries.
In the primaries, right.
When the people there very much wanted change, and they saw Bernie as the candidate of change, and they voted for him very, very heavily. And they saw Hillary as the candidate of the status quo. So they didn't vote for her. So then comes the November general election, and they were still looking for change, and they decided to take a shot with Trump. He presented himself as a candidate of change, and they knew Hillary wasn't a candidate of change, so Trump won.
Well, and apparently they liked what they saw in Trump, because Republican Tom Tiffany, big Trump supporter, easily defeated the Democrat Tricia Zunker by about 15 points, at least according to the results reported today. So is that a surprise, or are there lessons to be had for Democrats there?
Well, first of all, it's not a surprise. Second of all, Zunker did much better than Hillary did, and Zucker did much better than the Democrat who ran in 2018. So you know, yes, she lost, absolutely. I doubt she'll win because they're going to face each other again in November, and I doubt she'll win then either. But she's certainly on the right trajectory. She like I said, she got a better turnout than Hillary did, and a better turnout than the 2018 Democrat did. So she, you know, she's pretty good. You know, I think if she were more of a populist and a little bit less tepid, she might have done better. But she did okay. I felt good about it. She's not someone that Blue America endorsed, by the way, unlike Kara, who we very much endorsed and did everything we could to help.
And I should note, by the way, which I meant to at the top, but Howie threw me off completely, that he is the co-founder of the Blue America PAC, which is dedicated to raising small-dollar donations to help progressives, not Democrats, but progressives, win office. And he has...
Or you can put it another way.
Yeah.
Anyone in the Democratic Party that Dave Wasserman doesn't endorse, those are the ones who we raise money for.
I can't believe you are saying these things about my brother right to my face, Howie.
Well, I think he's listening.
Oh, okay. Well, he does, along with Mom and Dad. Okay. So let's go to the marquee race of the day on Tuesday. Perhaps marquee, if only because Donald Trump and the Republican Party over the weekend claimed that the election was being stolen by Democrats. Trump called it a rigged election on Twitter. He was calling for votes that were cast at a pop-up polling place over the weekend in the city of Lancaster to be thrown out, claiming that's how the Democrats were stealing the race, even though it was requested, that polling place, by the city's Republican mayor. Trump said it was an attempt by California Governor Gavin Newsom to steal the election. Every bit of which was false in numerous ways, but it was also the marquee race because it was the seat held by freshman Democrat Katie Hill, who flipped the seat north of Los Angeles here from red to blue during the 2018 blue tsunami election, before resigning in her first year amid a revenge porn and ethics scandal. So just 76% of the vote is unofficially reported today, Howie, and I believe that it was all vote-by-mail ballots that have arrived before Election Day make up that 76%. So it could change. But right now, it looks like the Republican former pilot turned defense contractor Mike Garcia, who was heavily pushed by Trump, appears, at least of now, to have pretty handily defeated the Democratic State Assemblywoman Christy Smith by about 12 points, flipping the district, which I believe also went for Hillary Clinton back in 2016, if I recall.
Yep.
Flipped it back now into Republican hands. So what happened here? How did the Dems lose a seat in the middle of a huge anti-Trump year in California? And why should... Nancy Pelosi and Sherry Bustos, who heads the DCCC, think closely about what happened there.
Well, let me get to that part last.
Okay.
Multi-part question that you just asked me. So first of all, I want to emphasize that this is a blue district. People don't think of it as a blue district, but there are about 30,000 more Democrats, registered Democrats, than there are registered Republicans. So, you know, it's about 162,000 registered Democrats and 134,000 registered Republicans.
And 100 no party preference who could go either way.
Which usually breaks down about the same way that the Democrats and Republicans break down. So it's the same, you know, the same kind of number. So that almost never changes it. So anyway, so it's a blue district. And before I get to what the Democrats did, I just want to say something else. A big part of the Democratic vote is the Hispanic vote, and there are a lot of Hispanics everywhere in Southern California, but especially in the Antelope Valley, which is the bluest part of this three valley district. It's Simi Valley in the west, Santa Clarita Valley in the middle, and then in the east, it's Antelope Valley. And that is a very Hispanic part of the district, although there are a lot of Hispanics in Santa Clarita Valley as well. And, you know, one name was Smith and the other name was Garcia. And, you know, that, you know, if people haven't been paying attention, that they realize. Okay, so that's one thing.
Right.
The other is that, and this is the important part, and that's that Christy Smith really was not is not, because she's going to be, again, running again in November, she's not a very good candidate. She isn't offering anything. She's another Republican light corporate candidate. She's not with it where the Democratic Party is now. She's, you know, into taking money from corporate PACs. Democrats don't like that anymore. She is not for things like Medicare for All or the Green New Deal. She's just a conservative Democrat, a very conservative Democrat. People don't care about that. But in the primary, the progressive in the race got between 6% and 7% of the vote. The only way numerically that she could have possibly won this thing, well, there are two ways. One is to get Republican votes, which doesn't make sense. They have their own candidate. What do they want with her? They've got a Republican. But the other way would to be to appeal to the progressives who didn't vote for her and to bring the party together. She didn't do that at all. She just went for Republicans, and that was her mistake.
Well, now, if why...
To get some Republicans to come and vote for her, and she didn't. And she alienated the progressives who voted for Cenk Uygur. And they weren't a large number, but when you look at the numbers, they were enough to have made the difference.
Well, let me press you on this, Howie. You say that the progressive here got 5 to 6% in the primary. That was, in fact,
6.5%.
Yeah. That was our friend Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks. He was running in this race in the primary. He failed to win either the support of the DCCC, the party establishment, or to win the ultimate nomination. If Democrats in this area of California are looking for a progressive, why was Cenk unable to get more support there?
Well, some Democrats are looking for a progressive. I didn't say that she should adopt his agenda. Mm-hmm. I said that she needed to bring the party together and to make some kind of an appeal to his voters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as Biden is doing right now, Biden is trying to appeal to Bernie voters. He knows he can't win without them. And she should have done the same thing. I'm not saying that she has to, you know, suddenly become a progressive. That's never going to happen. But she needed to do some kind of outreach to the people who didn't vote for her in the party. Mm. Otherwise, there aren't the numbers for her to win. And there weren't. And I mean, I did a post on my blog about a week or two ago, and I predicted that she would win. I didn't necessarily want her to win. I don't like her.
Mm-hmm.
But I said that she'd probably win a narrow victory.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a Democratic strategist come on my blog on Sunday, and he predicted that she would lose. And he said it would be pretty narrow. And in reality, it wasn't narrow at all. She lost by 10 points, which is shocking, absolutely shocking. And it's just that it wasn't that Democrats or progressives, say, went and voted for the Republican. That's not going to happen. They just didn't come and vote.
Mm-hmm.
That was what the ballots were showing. I mean, I know I'm not supposed to talk about this, so let's just keep it between ourselves.
Okay.
But the head of the Democratic Party...
Yeah.
Saw the votes coming in of the Democratic Party of Los Angeles. Saw the votes coming in, and knew 3 days ago that she was toast.
Mm.
The votes were not coming in from the right zip codes. They were coming in from Republican zip codes, but not from Democratic zip codes. And why was that? It's just because she didn't appeal to anybody. Nobody cared. She doesn't stand for anything. There's nothing. She stands for one thing. She has a D next to her name, and the votes that she got, other than for her pals, the votes that she got were because people just are robotically Democratic and they'll vote for any Democrat. But that it wasn't enough. Even in a Democratic district like the 25th, that is not enough.
And let me just underscore.
There was something. She had to be offering. If you're not saying to the voters, this is what I'm going to do for you, why should they care?
Let me just underscore that you said she lost by 10. It actually looks like she lost by 12 as of now, but that's with 76% of the vote in California. Ballots can still come in after Election Day, as long as they're postmarked by Election Day. So that number could narrow a bit, but 12 points is obviously a whole lot to overcome between now and the time the race is certified.
No, I think the race was already called.
What, by who?
I guess AP.
Well, AP doesn't call. They can call whatever they want. I wait for the numbers to come in, and in California, it can take up to 30 days.
Yeah, I was going to say, but could be waiting until next year.
Yeah, well, it could be a while, but we like to get it right here rather than quickly. As you know, here in California, Howie. All right, you said you reached out, by the way, to Cenk this morning for comment on why he thought that Smith had lost here. What did he tell you about it?
Well, he was being very kind, and he didn't want to put her down. And, you know, I wrote a post about it on my blog, mm-hmm. and I included, a quote from Cenk, and I'd be happy to read it for you if you want me to.
Sure.
But what he said is that in general, mm-hmm. Republicans tend to vote more. That was his point. And in a low turnout election, like a special election in the middle of a pandemic, for example, mm-hmm. the Republicans tend to win those. And he's right. But what he said was that probably any Democratic candidate would have lost. But the Democratic Party's insistence on picking the least dynamic or the least populist candidate doesn't help. Mike Garcia was more populist than Steve Knight. So Steve Knight had been the incumbent that Katie Hill defeated. Mm-hmm. And what he said is that Mike Garcia was more populist than Steve Knight, and the whole Republican Party supported Garcia and helped him win the primary. On the Democratic side, the party despises populism, so they all went very aggressively for the establishment candidate, Christy Smith. In primaries, especially very short ones like this, party endorsements make a huge difference, and the establishment rules the day. In general elections, undecided voters have the opposite motivation. They don't like the establishment. The Republican Party gives the candidates the trappings of outsiders, and the Democratic Party does the opposite. They give their candidates the appearance of being insiders. Independent voters don't like insiders. They're independents by definition, so they're outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
It also doesn't help that the Democratic Party leaders are lions against progressives in primaries and lambs against Republicans in the general. How much more vitriolic were they against me, Cenk,
yeah,
than against Mike Garcia? If they fought him half as hard as they fought me, they might have had a chance.
Yeah, I was actually taken by that line. It doesn't help that the Democratic Party leaders are lions against progressives in primaries and lambs against Republicans in the general. So I take it you concur with that part of Cenk's assessment?
I do.
There is still a whole bunch of upcoming primary elections, Howie, in a whole bunch of states, and I've got just a minute or so here, but I want to hit, these are states where even though Bernie Sanders has suspended his campaign and endorsed Joe Biden, he is remaining on the ballot to hopefully rack up delegates as leverage to help try to move the party to the progressive left. But there's a whole bunch of congressional and senatorial primaries in these upcoming states, including Oregon and Hawaii next week, and then on June 2nd, what has turned into another Super Tuesday with a bunch of states who had previously postponed their elections because of the virus, including Indiana, Maryland, Montana, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Dakota, and D.C., and then other states beyond that, Georgia, West Virginia, Kentucky, New York, Delaware, New Jersey, Louisiana, and Connecticut. They'll be voting in June and July.
And Arizona.
Did I miss Arizona?
Unless I missed you saying it.
No, I think you're right. I did miss it. And as you are the nation's greatest champion of progressives running for the U.S. House, Howie, any races that you would recommend?
And Dave,
of course.
Important races that are coming up, so important primaries that pit really progressive challengers against right wing or Blue Dog or New Dems.
Mm-hmm.
One of them that's coming up next week is in Oregon, mm-hmm. where a really awful Blue Dog named Kurt Schrader is defending his seat against the mayor of Milwaukee. So this is Milwaukee with an IE at the end, not EE. So it's Milwaukee, which is a small city outside, south of Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor there is Mark Gamba, mm-hmm. who is a real live progressive. And like I said, he's up against Kurt Schrader, a real live Blue Dog. So that's a really important one. Another really important
one. We got a lot of listeners in Oregon. So I want to underscore that one. Mark Gamba in Oregon. All right, go ahead.
Another one is Eva Petrova, who is a town councilman in Flagstaff, Arizona, and she's running against another blue dog. Actually, this is the one with the quotation marks around former Republican. Mm-hmm. He was a Republican state senator. He got in a fight with them, although not over policy, and he became a so-called blue dog Democrat, and he still votes with the Republicans very frequently. And his name is Tom O'Halloran, and Eva is taking him on, and that's in Arizona's 1st District, which is about half the state in terms of land mass.
Right.
And then another race that's really interesting is in Queens, in the south eastern part of Queens and a little bit into Nassau County, is a district, the 5th District, where Shaniat Chowdhury. Now, Sean is a captain of a international soccer team, which in fact is a championship, not soccer. I'm sorry, rugby team.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to work in the he worked for the New York State Legislature. He's a really, really smart guy, and he's young. He's charismatic. He worked for AOC's campaign when she ran, and he's running now against the boss of the New York Democratic machine, the Queens Democratic machine. So when AOC won, she defeated the boss of that machine.
Mm-hmm.
And now the new boss is a guy named Greg Meeks, who was judged to be the most corrupt Democrat in the House.
So you're saying new boss, same as the old boss?
Yeah, new boss may be worse than the old boss.
Okay.
And so Sean is taking him on. In New York 5. That's another very important one. There is a race in Oklahoma City. I think it might be a little bit quixotic, but because it's a pretty red district, and a blue dog managed to get in there. And she's just been horrible since she got in 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. Her name is Kendra Horn. Mm-hmm. And the guy who's taking her on is a progressive professor named Tom Guild. So another very important race.
Now you have a list. People can donate, support these folks if they like via Act Blue, which I think we can get to from downwithtyranny.com. Is that correct?
No.
No?
You can. If you go,
Where's your list? Where's Howie's list? Everybody wants Howie's list. Yes.
Well, Howie has a few lists. That's
okay.
The problem.
Okay.
So this particular list that I'm going over now is just for primaries of progressives taking on blue dogs. That's it. There's a more general list that some of these people are on as well, and that's the Howie. That's the big one. That list, if you just go to downwithtyranny.com, on the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little Act Blue thing, and, that,
right.
And if you press on that, you get to the list.
Okay. Well, is that the one that says Blue America?
Yes. It
okay.
says Blue America. You just hit that, and you're right there. You see the names, and if you want to donate, you can donate right then and there, whether to one candidate or two candidates or all the candidates. It's fun.
All right, very good. Glad to know that. I will link folks over to there for more of Howie's list, which you ought to just call it Howie's list at this point, Howie.
I have two partners who work as hard as I do on this.
Oh, the hell with them. That's Digby and John Amato.
That's right.
Oh, who needs them?
Yeah,
all right.
I
yeah, I do too. All right. Hey, thanks, Howie. We will not make it another, 2 years, I think, since we talked to you last time. Maybe we'll even talk to you before the new Super Tuesday on June 2nd and get some more of your thoughts and recommendations. Howie Klein, always great speaking with you, my friend. You can find his work, of course, at downwithtyranny.com. You can find him on the Twitters at downwithtyranny. And, of course, you'll find that link to his Blue America Pack, which, yes, is co-founded with our friend John Amato of Crooks and Liars. And, of course, Heather Digby Parton, a regular guest on the broadcast. Hey, Howie, great speaking with you, my friend. Let's do it again soon.
Absolutely. That was fun.
Thank you, brother. Okay, we got to go. Thank you very much to my producer, Desi Doyen,
yes.
To all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That service and this service, the show itself, is made possible by listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. to help keep us going. Thank you. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.